From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Over the past several weeks, we've been keeping a close eye on developments with PG&E and the newest rate hike that's now in place. And we've reported the utility wants to raise rates even more in the coming months, arguing the repeated increases are to cover safety upgrades largely tied to wildfires. The estimate from the ratepayer advocacy organization TURN says the increases could push the average monthly bill to $300, which is particularly a strain if you're low, middle, or on a fixed income or housing insecure. And outside of state utility regulators who approve these increases, there doesn't seem to be an end to rate hikes as long as the California Public Utilities Commission gives its blessing. Many people have ideas on how to change the system, but nothing at the moment seems to stick. We invited PG&E to join us, but they were unable to make it. But Central Valley Congress member Representative Josh Harder has been an outspoken critic of PG&E's rate hikes. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. to talk solutions. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Congressman Harder, you represent the 9th District, so that includes places like Stockton, Lodi, Manteca. And according to the latest census data, the median household income is $86,000. The average rent in your district is $1,600, and about 1 in 10 live under the poverty line. You mentioned in your press release calling out PG&E that you have been hearing a lot from your constituents. What are they telling you?
People are telling us enough is enough. We've already seen PG&E double their rates over the last 10 years, and that was before their latest price increase. Last summer's heat wave devastated our community in terms of the bills that folks were facing afterwards. I was having bills sent to me from all across our area, including some as high as $1,000 a month just to keep up the air conditioning. People have said enough is enough.
Okay, so you're getting this messaging from your constituents. You now publicly have called out PG&E. This needs to come to an end. What can you do at the federal level as a Congress member? I mean, my understanding is that this is a state issue and it falls on state utility regulators.
Absolutely, that the PUC should be doing more to keep PG&E in check. Those are the folks in Sacramento who are in charge of making sure that these rate increases are not exorbitant. I don't think they've been doing a very good job. And so I think we need federal authority as well. Think about your rent. Right now, there are legal limits to how much and how often your landlord can hike up your rent. And that makes all the sense in the world because you could lose your housing if you have an unanticipated expense that blows your budget. You know, frankly, I think we should have those same controls for the price increases that a utility company like PG&E is making in a particular year.
When you say that the feds should step in, I mean, is this FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission? I mean, what realistically can happen at the federal level to change rate hikes, to curb them, or to at least put pressure to reduce them?
I think at the very least, we should have federal legislation that limits the number of price increases a utility company can make in a year. A lot of this comes down to transparency. We know that PG&E has to upgrade their infrastructure. Frankly, I think they can pay for it a lot of different ways. They paid their CEO $50 million a year. Maybe they can find some resources to upgrade their infrastructure from their executive bonuses. But the least that we want is to make sure that they come about this price increase in a transparent way. Right now, if this goes as planned, families will be getting their bills in March and wondering what the heck happened.
I do have to fact check you on that. PG&E does not pay Patty Poppy $50 million a year. I talked to PG&E about this back in 2022. Over $40 million of that. This stems from 2021. Patty Poppy, when she left her previous utility company, over $40 million was a one-time equity payment. I believe her salary is more in line with benefits, around $14 million. And PG&E says that when you look at other CEOs in investor-owned utility companies, Patty Poppy CEO is in the middle of the pack. So is there a larger problem, a larger issue that you have with how investor-owned utility CEOs are compensated?
I spent my career working in the private sector, and I can tell you without a doubt that I have never seen a company that paid its CEOs $50 million a year in 2021, which they did, the same year that PG&E declared bankruptcy. And to say that a $14 million a year salary today is somehow any better when they have unpaid liabilities and they are preventing from themselves from actually upgrading their infrastructure and strengthening their efforts against wildfires, I think makes no sense at all. Ultimately, there needs to be a watchdog. And if the California Public Utilities Commission is not acting as that watchdog, then we need federal authorities to do that.
Is this just a California issue? Is this just a PG&E issue? They are the largest utility company, I believe, in the country. They serve 16 million customers here in California. Or when you're talking to your colleagues at the federal level, other Congress members, say in like Florida or other states, is this a bigger issue?
It's absolutely a bigger issue. It's not a shock that if you have a public utility that has a natural monopoly in a given part of a state and very cushy relations with the regulators that are overseeing them in the state's capital, that you're going to have, that public utilities commission go off the rails a little bit. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Sacramento right now, but it's not a California specific story. We've seen a lot of other states have that exact same problem. And that's why I think federal legislation makes sense, because clearly the way that we're doing it right now in California is broken.
When it comes to California, I understand that you represent a district at the national level. Have you talked with Governor Newsom or the CPUC when you're talking about kind of a compliance with PG&E and how it operates, they're part of that.
We have. We talked to our colleagues in the California State Legislature, and I think that there's a number of legislative priorities that folks are moving in Sacramento as well. It can't happen soon enough. We've already seen the impacts of this over the last decade when PG&E has doubled their rates. And now to have a 13% increase in November and then asking for another price hike just a few weeks later, there's no end to what PG&E's greed is going to continue to ask for. And it's not that they're actually putting this money where it needs to be. So there needs to be checks and balances in this system. And frankly, I think it's absolutely the case that both legislators in Sacramento and in D.C. should be doing more to make sure that that happens.
So given that you have talked to people at the state level, whether it's like the CPUC, what are they telling you? Do they agree with you? Because they did approve the latest rate increase.
They did. I've been talking to folks in the state legislature, and that's one of the problems with the California Public Utilities Commission is they don't have as many checks and balances with the state legislature as they need. And so you have, folks that don't have a whole lot of people watching their efforts, and then they only know about it when they see the price increases a couple of weeks or a couple months later. So my goal is to make sure that we're keeping our eye on the ball in D.C., and I think the best first step is to make sure that we are limiting the number of price increases that a utility company like PG&E can do in any given year.
Yeah, as I mentioned, we invited PG&E to come on. They were not available today, but they did share with us an email and some statements ahead of this conversation because they knew that we were going to be talking to you. And overall, I think they take issue with how you're framing these increases. For example, leaving out storm damage, which was extensive from last year's winter storms. It included like more than a dozen atmospheric rivers in which PG&E says they restored power to over 7 million customers. How do you expect the utility company to make up for those losses outside of rate increases?
Well, I have another bill that is asking to take clawback bonuses from their executives the year that they went bankrupt. Why should they be giving out tens of millions of dollars in bonuses when they're going bankrupt and not investing that money into their infrastructure? And so I think if you look at the history of PG&E, we have seen repeated mismanagement, not by the folks on the ground who are working hard to make sure that our power lines stay open, but by the elite executives that continue to hand themselves multi-million dollar paychecks instead of putting those resources where they're absolutely needed, fixing the storm damage, addressing the risk of wildfires. Let's invest in that instead of paying folks way too much money when they frankly don't really need it because they're not doing a good job.
You mentioned that you have a bill. I mean, are there other lawmakers in other states, other Congress members that are on board with this? How are you working with Congress members across the country?
We're building a big coalition. I think this should be one of the most bipartisan ideas out there. One of the things that I learned in the private sector is if people aren't doing a good job, then you replace them and you bring in a new team. We, I think, need that in PG&E, given the history of mismanagement we've seen in this utility. They're continuing to ask for one price increase after another. And if you look back and you look at their budget and what have they done with all of the money that has been given to PG&E, they clearly have not invested it appropriately because the risk of wildfires, the risk of storm damage hasn't gone down.
Hmm. Given that, you know, since you're at the national level, have you spoken with the Biden administration, perhaps, you know, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm about this?
We're gonna work on this legislation and absolutely send it to folks. I think this is something that should get a lot of support because I think this is something that we, again, mirrors the same type of legal limits that we already have for rental properties.
Hmm. According to the Wall Street Journal, PG&E asked the federal government, the Department of Energy, for a $7 billion loan last year. I mean, so this is another connection of how PG&E, you know, works with or is impacted by the federal government. Is this something that you're aware of? Is this regular for utility companies across the country to apply for loans like this?
There were a lot. I think the loan that you're referring to was specifically as part of the Inflation Reduction Act, which was focused on trying to make sure that we're modernizing utilities, pushing them to 100% renewable energy, and also trying to make sure that we're safeguarding them from climate change, from those wildfires that are clearly a huge problem across California. Again, those are the sorts of things that I think are an appropriate way for PG&E to pay for its costs. I absolutely agree that we need to upgrade PG&E's infrastructure. Frankly, I think that should have been done decades ago. There are so many very clear things that PG&E could do. For instance, taking their power lines and putting them below ground. I know that's significantly more expensive, but it dramatically decreases the risk of wildfire damage. I think we can actually make sure that there are loans and grants for programs like that instead of the way that PG&E is currently using their rate increases. And I think that they have to account for the rate increases that they've already had just over the last decade.
We've had Mark Tomey on before, and he's the executive director of TURN. That is a ratepayer advocacy organization. It stands for the Utility Reform Network. And he had a couple proposals. I'm curious if you're in support of this. I mean, he proposes capping utility rates at the rate of inflation of Social Security or basing rates on income. What do you think of these proposals?
I think some type of cap, whether on the amount of price increases or on the number of price increases, makes a lot of sense, whether it's inflation or something else. I think the key challenge with PG&E is that PG&E is more subject to climate change than most other businesses. And so that's why we're seeing the wildfires and the storms become a key problem. So I have no issue with the fact that this infrastructure needs to be upgraded, but why should it be done in a non-transparent way with one rate increase after another? But I absolutely agree that, similar to a lot of rent control we already have, that some sort of cap probably makes sense to give families certainty.
You've called PG&E a monopoly. Do you think it should be broken up?
I think it already is being broken up in a lot of places in Northern California. Many cities are moving to local cooperatives because it's, frankly, a heck of a lot cheaper than PG&E. Unfortunately, they're sort of doing that against the efforts of PG&E and the Public Utilities Commission, which is trying to stop it. But one of the things that we can do is locally make sure that every single city in Northern California has the opportunity to form one of these utility cooperatives to give lower prices to their ratepayers.
Have you directly spoken with PG&E CEO Patty Poppe or anyone with the utility company? And how, if so, how have those conversations gone?
We've kept them in close updates on our bills and legislation. Obviously, this is something that I've worked on for a long time.
And what do they think about it?
I think, well, obviously, they're not very supportive of what we're trying to do here. And they argue that they need this money. I think that makes, you know, a little bit of sense. Certainly, they need to upgrade their infrastructure. But this is not a problem that was created just over the last couple months. PG&E spent years and years paying these exorbitant executive salaries and bonuses, at the cost of actually upgrading their infrastructure. And now, when we see these natural disasters, they're just trying to put the cost of those disasters onto the ratepayers instead of to the company that was the root cause of why those disasters had such damage to begin with.
When it comes to the bill that you're talking about, also the proposal for a coalition nationally, what stage are you in at that point? I mean, where are we? And realistically, I mean, how do you see this moving forward, say, like this year?
I think it can happen soon enough. I don't think PG&E is going to stop with their latest rate increase proposal. I think they're going to continue to push and push and push until either the Public Utilities Commission grows a spine or we have further state or federal legislation that has some set of standard that actually makes sure that we're able to hold PG&E's feet to the fire here. So we're going to try to make this as broad a coalition as we can. As I said earlier, there are a lot of states that are seeing a similar set of challenges, and hopefully we can make this a bipartisan success.
Just so I understand, when it comes to federal energy regulators, FERC, do they oversee state regulators like the CPUC?
Not directly. FERC's jurisdiction is more about the transmission. They don't have direct jurisdiction today over these types of rate increases, but there's no reason why there can't be more checks and balances in this process, because clearly, as I said, the way it's working right now is broken.
Finally, I mean, as you are well aware, California is moving towards a more electrified system with electric vehicles, for example, you know, getting off of gas stoves and just going more towards electric appliances. How confident are you that California, and wrapped within that is a utility company like PG&E, as well as other ones in Southern California, that it can be a reliable, affordable source of energy? And if I think you're going to say you're not very confident, what alternatives are there? Because California is moving in this direction regardless.
We need to modernize our grid across California. We remember just a couple decades ago how devastating the brownouts and blackouts were. Now, when we're seeing 115, 120 degree summers, the risk of those blackouts is even more devastating, and not just from air conditioning. To your point, the entire life that somebody is living is now connected to the grid, whether it's their car, whether it's their job. We need
medical devices.
Medical devices, there absolutely is a need for reliable and affordable electricity everywhere you go. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that PG&E is going to be able to deliver that. So that's why I think we need a watchdog here that's going to make sure that PG&E is held to account. I hope the PUC can do that. If not, then we're going to supplement that or try to supplement that through federal authority. The second thing that I'd really like to see a much greater role for, as I said before, is these localized city-based cooperatives. The city of Stockton is moving to one of those cooperatives. It can't happen soon enough because it's going to lower rates and it's going to create a more reliable source of energy for the folks that live within that city. There's no reason why most places in Northern California can't have something like that. And so they don't have to rely just on what PG&E is providing.
Representative Harder, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
That is Congressmember Josh Harder, and we want to reiterate that we did invite PG&E CEO Patty Poppe on today, but she was unavailable. Up next, Sac City High School is among the first in the state training students as EV technicians. We'll learn about the pilot program that creates a pathway for a career in electric and hybrid vehicles. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California is pushing for a greener and more environmentally friendly future, especially when it comes to driving. Electric and hybrid vehicles, they're becoming more and more popular. But California also has a requirement that by 2035, that's just over a decade from now, all new cars being sold in the state will have to be zero emission. And just like their regular gas-guzzling counterparts, these vehicles are going to need a lot of maintenance, which also means that there's a lot of new and good-paying career opportunities in this emerging automotive field. And there's also a push to get people interested in those jobs at a younger age. This month, a Sacramento City Unified High School became one of the first in the state to offer a pilot program focused on setting students up for the future careers as EVs EV technicians. Joining us to talk about this new program are Cap Radio education reporter Shrishti Prabha and JP Polanco, the program's instructor at John F. Kennedy High School. Good morning to afternoon to you both.
Afternoon.
Afternoon. Yeah.
All right, Shrishti, I want to start with your reporting first. Why did you choose to feature the program?
Well, I'm always checking in with districts on new developments, and I was told about this one, and it sounded super unique. I hadn't heard about any other such programs in the county, and after some research, there's just not that many programs in the state or even in the country, so it felt like something I should highlight.
Yeah, I just anecdotally, looking on the roads, like electric vehicles are becoming more and more popular. Did you get an idea in terms of numbers how common they are in the state?
Yeah, after talking to some experts like John Volker, who is an automotive reporter specializing in electric vehicles, I learned that in California this year, so this was last year, one in four new cars has a plug. So that's quite a few. And what he told me was this was way ahead of the rest of the country. And this is to meet the demand of the California mandate, which will have all new cars sold in the state be zero emissions by 2035. Creating like high paying job opportunities in the industry, having the potential to, saturate the market.
You know, given that this pilot program is really focusing on high schoolers to introducing them to a potential career as EV technicians, that kind of leads me to believe that we don't have enough as it stands. So, I mean, where is this industry today compared to the demand since it is increasing and becoming more popular on roadways?
Right. The narrative I got from multiple experts in the industry is that there's a void of EV technicians. JB, who is here with me today, actually connected me to an EV technician recruiter named Frank Kattar, who he brought to his class to talk about career pathways. And Frank told me that in his class, that in the classroom, he explained how like there's a changing automotive landscape and that actually there just aren't that many electric vehicle technicians.
EVs, so yeah, electric vehicles. Clearly, they're becoming more popular. More people are buying them. Is there a technician need for them? 100%. Is there a lack of technicians out there? 100%. Yeah. If you think about how many high schools back in the day had auto shop, you know, a lot of high schools did. Well, today, many high schools have gotten rid of the auto shop. There's a lot of individuals not going into the trade.
And another thing he noted was that the transition for a standard automotive technician to an electric vehicle technician is a really difficult one. And after speaking with John Volker, what I learned was that there's all this new technology. So there's three parts to an electric vehicle that are not part of standard automotive combustion engines. So you have a battery, you have an electric motor, and you have power electronics, which have various circuits and move power around. So you really have to learn a whole new set of language.
The idea here is that starting ideally in high school and certainly in community colleges that have good vocational training programs, we need a whole variety of new courses dealing with new materials that's never been used in the automotive sphere before.
Okay, so I better understand the problem that we're presented with, especially here in California. But when it comes to actually getting people into this career, you know, what makes this field attractive?
It's super lucrative. So what I learned was EV technician salaries can range from $140,000 to $160,000 a year, potentially more with more certifications, which is so much money.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. And you don't even need a college education. You know, I think about student loans. And so those could be non-existent. Why was Sac City Unified? Why did it become home to like one of the first EV career pathways for students, I believe, in the county and also statewide?
Yeah, one of the main reasons was that they already had a class and a space with all the facilities you need for this career pathway in place. So the only additional things that would be required were just the actual, machinery that would be required for an EV car. And so talking to Daniel Spinka, who's the career readiness director for the district, he had been waiting on workforce grants in order to actually acquire the things that are needed to have an EV forward curriculum. And he said one of the biggest challenges was that it's unattainably higher amount of money if a classroom facility is not already built.
you know, ideally we have more than one program, but then there's the reality of hopefully we have a community willing to make a multi-million dollar investment.
And he says that if the district witnessed a huge demand for the program, they would consider replicating the model. So,
okay. So mm-hmm. this high school benefited from having the infrastructure, but it's still a sizable financial commitment. Given that you visited the high school just a little over a month ago, can you kind of give us a visual? Describe what you saw as an outsider in the classroom.
Yeah, I think JB's in there every day. But for me, it was quite new because what Frank was saying earlier is we did not have an auto shop class at my school, so I've never seen a space like that. A large warehouse space with tools and equipment and machinery to hitch up cars. Like, I've truly never been in something like that, so it was kind of incredible to see. And then there was also a little classroom in the back so you could teach and then, you know, do actually hands-on work.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about a new electric vehicle pilot program that recently launched at John F. Kennedy High School within Sac City Unified, training students as EV technicians. Okay, so now I want to move to JB Polanco, who is the high school program's instructor. JB, how did you get involved in this?
I just seen that Sac City was hiring for an automotive teacher. I applied. When I applied, I was under the impression that it was going to be a traditional automotive program. And then once I was onboarded and on ground, you know, it was kind of dropped on me that it was actually going to be an EV program. And so that's how I was introduced to it. I thought I was going to a traditional program, but, you know.
That seems like a pretty big curveball. How did you adjust to that?
I'm still actually in the process of adjusting. So, I mean, trying to figure it out how to cater the curriculum to be electric vehicle based, because all automotive programs in general have an aspect of EV technology to them, but it's usually just a part of the program. So I'm trying to figure out and navigate how to make it the core of the program, and that's kind of what I'm in the process of doing right now.
I know that this pilot program just started this month, so, you know, it's kind of like it's at the simmer stage right now. But what excites you about this program?
I would have to say that the amount of support that we're receiving and the amount of excitement in the community. I mean, I'm here today talking with you. And thanks to Srishti, we got a lot of exposure, and the program has a bright light shining on it right now. So a lot of members of the community have stepped forward to really endorse and support the program. I mean, SMUD has reached out and said they're interested in partnering with us to make something happen. Also, before Christmas, the city of Sacramento reached out as well. So they're looking to partner with us to create opportunities for our students and to help transition to the zero emissions goal that the city of Sacramento has as a whole.
Yeah, and the reason why we have this pilot program is because I would imagine over the decades and generations, you know, there has been this trend, at least at the high school level, away from technical trades, whether it's shop class or home ec or what have you. I would imagine you obviously had a background as a technician or a mechanic. I mean, you probably have a really intimate understanding of the issue that creates for the automotive industry.
Yeah, I definitely am from the trades, and I know there's a lot of trades. And like you mentioned, a lot of schools moved away from them because, you know, we were told computers were the future, right? So if they did have any additional programs or vocational programs, they shifted their focus to meeting the demand for that market sector. And now, the people who've been working in the trades, whether it's automotive, carpenters, plumbers, whatever it is, there's huge vacancies because they're not being taught anywhere. So not just in the automotive industry itself, but any trade-based work, there's a high demand for it right now, and they're all creating good opportunities for people to make living wages. So it's looking good if you want to be a tradesman. And like you guys mentioned, it's something that you can earn a good living with without having to go to college.
Yeah, I mean, Trishy was saying salaries in the six figures, you know, and this also goes along. We've had these conversations on Insight. I mean, the desire to go to college has been challenging in recent years. So this could be, you know, a really viable, realistic alternative, you know, going into trade schools.
Absolutely. I just wanted to add that Sacramento County now is somewhat trying to focus a little more on career and technical pathways because they've had a very low overall rate of students pursuing four-year degrees. So this is a great alternative pathway. Having someone like JB also go through that transition kind of shows how hard it is. I know he didn't really talk about it, but he's learning on the go, you know, and then having to innovate like the curriculum so that it adapts. And I feel like that might be the best way to do it. you know, because you can actually teach kids what the transition's going to be. I don't know, JB, if you want
to
add.
And it goes back to Volker, is that who?
Yeah.
Where he was mentioning that, you know, we're going to have to introduce training programs that basically don't exist, right? So automotive programs typically have an accreditation standard that all programs meet, right? And that's what I'm used to. That's what I'm accustomed to. So when I first came into this job, that was what I envisioned in my head, was aligning my program to those standards. But to meet the demand for the EV technicians and the path that the district has identified it wants to take, I'm having to rethink that whole model and that accreditation process. And that's where I'm at right now, is trying to figure out if I can set my program up to where I'm meeting the vision of the district and still meeting those accreditation standards. And I may not meet accreditation standards, but as long as I'm accomplishing what the district has set out to do, then I think I'll be comfortable with that and happy with that result in the end, because we will be preparing our students for college and career success.
You know, given I go back, you know, many, many moons ago when I was in high school, I went to public school, part of Los Angeles Unified. There weren't really many, you know, kind of trade programs at my high school. So for me, reflexively, and for my classmates and friends too, you think like, oh, you know, go to college, or I won't go to college and I'll get a job doing something else. By having these kind of trade educations at the high school level, it actually just lets students know that there are alternatives out there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's an important part of it, is letting students know, even the community as a whole, that there are well-paying opportunities out there in the trades. I mean, obviously, I represent the mechanical trade or the automotive trade. But like I mentioned earlier, there's lots of opportunities in all the fields. So it is a good opportunity for people who don't pursue the typical college route. So,
given that you're in shop or in class, you know, every day at school, I mean, how receptive are students to this? I mean, what are they telling you?
Students overall seem excited. They're you know, eager to learn, and I'm eager to teach them. But, you know, like I said, right now we're still in the preliminary stages, so we are kind of more a traditional automotive program. And so some of the seniors who are going to be leaving and going out into the world, you know, they're a little like, so this is all going to happen next year, right? So they kind of feel like they're being left out. But, you know, I just tell them, you know, there is opportunities for you to pursue this. It'll just have to be at the community college level, right? So you're not going to be able to get it in high school. But there are, you know, community colleges, you know, American River or Consumers River, they have programs to where if they truly are interested in this career field, they can go and continue to pursue that at post-secondary education level.
When it comes to Sac City Unified, I mean, it's one of many school districts in the county, but this school district is incredibly diverse. You know, when it comes to offering this kind of opportunity, this pilot program, you know, how is that reflective of the diversity of the student body at your high school?
I think that's something that I've been giving a lot of consideration to recently, especially since, you know, I found out that SMUD is interested in partnering with us in the city of Sacramento. And that's another evolution that I'm having in my thought process as far as developing the curriculum, is obviously there needs to be the service and diagnostic part of it. But I'm also thinking about like the transportation side of it, right? Creating equitable transportation solutions for the community as a whole. Because when you think about EVs, typically who drives EVs? More affluent people, right?
Yeah, marginalized communities. They're expensive.
Yeah, you know, the communities where my school is, most of them aren't going to have the means to purchase an EV. So with partnering with the city and with SPUD, I think part of our program is work-based learning, to where students are solving real-world problems, to where we could partner with SMUD and with the city of Sacramento to come up with transportation solutions for more marginalized communities who can't afford an EV, whatever that might be, but building the infrastructure, you know, maybe getting them the electric scooters or whatever options that might be there. You know, a voucher for parking downtown doesn't necessarily benefit the students in my community, right? So I'm excited to partner with them to find other solutions that might be more beneficial to the community that attends my school and that we serve.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Shrishti, what did you experience when you went to class?
Yeah, we talked a lot of actually about the diversity of the classroom, especially the type of students he's teaching. You know, JFK High is a highly diverse school. Majority of the students are Hispanic, Asian, and Black, and that tracks kind of with the student demographics of the district. But what I thought was even more interesting, and I don't know if JB wants to kind of talk about it a little more, was how he wanted to include women and LGBTQ students and minority people into the curriculum that he was going to write. And before, JB, you say anything, I do want to hear from Karina Morales, who's a student in his class and who told me the impact that he has had on her.
We had like a lot of guest speakers and they were telling us about good things in the automotive industry. And I think that's a good job to have, especially if you're a girl, because like people don't expect girls to be in there. So.
Yeah, what do you think about that, JB, what your student Karina said?
I mean, I'm glad she decided to share. But it is a career field that a lot of people don't go into. So I'm trying to be inclusive with the curriculum as I develop it to where students can see their culture, their identities reflected in it, whether, you know, it be their ethnic background or their whatever, right? Just to where they could see themselves reflected in the curriculum to where they will have an interest in it and want to pursue it. So I think that's an important part of it. I think students need to be able to see themselves to want to pursue something. So that's kind of why I'm trying to make that happen.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think even if, you know, someone maybe doesn't want to go into this career, it is just such invaluable information to know how to work on your vehicle. That is not something to be taken for granted. And it can be very expensive to work on your car, to pay for someone to do it. And so I just think that alone, like, knowledge is power.
Right. And you could save yourself, you know, thousands of dollars, you know, tens of thousands of dollars over your lifetime, just being able to do small little maintenance procedures like oil changes, you know, rotate your tires, brakes, simple things like that that can be taught, you know, in a couple of weeks.
With an EV, you don't have to do those things. Less money.
They still have brakes. They still have tires.
The brakes, but yeah, the other stuff.
So some of those skills will translate from internal combustion to the EV sector. A lot of that stuff is compatible. And then just the basic understanding of how things work mechanically and that mechanical aptitude and you know, just being able to use tools that will also transition to it pretty well.
It can also be intimidating. So removing that intimidation factor as well and just feeling confident and comfortable with kind of navigating around a car and an engine, I think is just invaluable. Finally, Srishti, I mean, this is a pilot program. It's a rare one. Is there any idea that this could expand within the county or just even within other counties in California?
It probably will. I feel like actually, JB hadn't shared with me all the people that had reached out to him, and some of them were other districts. So it sounds like this could potentially be something that expands. That's kind of amazing that through this reporting, we were able to shine light on something and hold the system accountable and have that, you know, potentially expand out. I think it's super important because equity is such a big deal. So having equitable access to a program like this would be important.
Srishti and JB, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That is CAP Radio education reporter Srishti Prabha and JB Polanco from John F. Kennedy High School, which is within Sac City Unified. And they were talking about a new electric vehicle pilot program, which is training high school students as EV technicians. It is among one of the first of its kind in the state. Still ahead, Sacramento has long been one of the most diverse cities in the country, and that can create a challenge for those with language and cultural barriers. We'll learn about how the city is partnering with community ambassadors to bridge that gap. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Back in 2002, Time Magazine called Sacramento America's most diverse city. Today, it's still among the country's most diverse metropolitan areas. However, when it comes to sharing important information and resources, language and cultural barriers can be a challenge. In recent years, the city of Sacramento has been turning to the public for help with reaching out to many communities, particularly those in under-resourced neighborhoods. These people are called community ambassadors, and they help the city build bridges with diverse groups. And this month, the newest cohort of ambassadors will be announced. Here to provide a deeper look at the program, along with its goals and impacts, are Lynette Hall, the Community Engagement Manager for the City of Sacramento, and a community ambassador himself, Juan Carlos Ruiz. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Lynette, I want to start with you. I mean, what led to the creation of the Community Ambassadors Program? Because it's relatively new. Within the last few years?
Yeah, so it started out as a pilot project. We really looked at the Aggie Square project and the amount of resources that are coming. It's in the Oak Park area. Along the Stockton Boulevard. And we know that there's going to be a lot of dollars pouring into that project. And we wanted to make sure that folks knew about it. And so we created a pilot project that looked at the key demographics in that neighborhood, languages that were spoken. And so the first community ambassador program was actually only 7 ambassadors. Oftentimes, we know that cultural and language barriers have historically prevented people from feeling engaged with government. And so we wanted to try to figure creative ways. As the community engagement manager, my job is to design creative and effective outreach strategies. And so we tried it, and it worked, and we've expanded to 18. Sometimes people are more comfortable with people that look like them or speak the first language. As a city of Sacramento, we have to be comfortable with that as well.
Do you have an idea of how many languages are spoken in the city, given that you've grown your community ambassadors to more than a dozen now?
Yeah, so we really looked at some of the languages that more than 5% of the population speak. It's not a lot. Most folks are bilingual, but from a cultural perspective, people just feel comfortable talking to people that they know. And so the city has leveraged neighborhood associations and community-based organizations for years, but we wanted to make sure that we provided training and stipends to support that work. A lot of times your values go by, you know, your budget and how you support folks. And so we currently, of our last cohort, we were able to address 11 different languages and cultures. Super excited. We've received over 170 applications for this cohort. And it's always a learning process. Government has never done this before, where you pay community members directly. So every year we learn what works, what doesn't work. We started out, you know, paying a certain stipend amount, and then we realized that we're asking our ambassadors to do more, and so we should pay more. And we also want to make sure that they're trained efficiently as well. And so that's one of the changes that we've made this year, making some of the trainings required.
You know, Juan Carlos, you're one of the ambassadors. You know, you were drawn to this. You know, what drew you to the Community Ambassadors Program within the city?
Well, precisely the opportunity to serve the community. I am conscious, because of my daily work with the Consulate of Mexico, that language is a big barrier, and not everybody is literate enough in terms of literature or technology to go and browse. So getting the information in a digested form to them, to me, was very important. So that's what drew me, the opportunity to get this information directly to them.
Yeah, and you're, I mean, putting foot to pavement. You are talking to these people directly to help, you know, get them information and resources and just make them feel more comfortable, you know, with being engaged. What of the biggest strides have you experienced, you know, last year being an ambassador?
Well, we had the opportunity to bring the city and the consulate into a large educational fair that we organized. And we prepared a play, a theater play with puppets, in which we communicated some of the programs that the city have for the community in a friendly manner, in a way in which people found entertainment. And it broke the barrier of, well, the authorities, I don't trust them. I kind of see them with suspiciousness. So in a way, I think being the liaising part of the project is beautiful, because you get to hear what the city has to offer, and then you get to bring the needs of your community and communicate them. So it's a beautiful job to be able to be the bridge between those two and ensure that actually the projects and the programs that are designed to help those that need it most are actually reaching those that need it most in a way that they can comprehend and understanding, not only with languages, but also the depth of what it means sometimes. You know, for us, sitting there and hearing firsthand from the authorities how they design a project, it can be convoluted, it can be difficult. So it's important that we understand it, and then we take it to the community in a digested way.
Yeah. I mean, given that, you know, you are focused on, you know, the Latino community, you know, because you work at the Mexican consulate, when you're working with your colleagues as ambassadors, working with other communities, do you guys, because Lynette mentioned, like, this is a learning process, this isn't something that is really foundational to how a city functions. I mean, do you guys kind of, you know, workshop together what works, what doesn't?
Absolutely, yes. I think it's been a privilege to be able to sit down and learn from the other communities. Because as you say, we tend to be in this isolated pocket of serving a group of or language or ethnic group. And the opportunities to mingle or to get out of our comfort zone to understand what other minorities facing similar or dissimilar circumstances are facing is not that easy. And so this has given us a chance to learn what other communities are facing, what challenges they have to overcome, and what beautiful things they're doing, you know, in terms of cultural projects, festivals. Share with them, because at the end of the day, we are all members of the same city, of the same community, and we enrich one another. So I don't know, Lynette maybe has different experiences with that, but I love to hear from the other ambassadors and the other communities, different parts of the city as well.
Yeah, it's been great to see different cultures of the ambassadors work closely together. One of the things we also do is we break bread together, we eat together. And so every month, we use different ethnic cuisines, so people get an opportunity to experience different types of food. We always support small businesses, so all of the food are always provided by small businesses. But we also provide a stipend for folks to get creative about how they outreach to their communities. And so Juan, a great example is that we were promoting grants for artists. Up to $10,000. This was a program that came through some of the ARPA funds. And we wanted to make sure that our diverse community knew about it. And so Juan said, hey, my community is really interested in this. And so he actually created a bilingual puppet show that really walked folks through how to apply for this artist grant. And we saw the immediate impacts. We saw that with that program, over 75% of the grants went to folks of color, which was a really huge success for us. And so I think that's where we see the impact. Me, from the city perspective, I see the impact when I see different voices being centered, when I see different proposals coming that have never come before, when I see small business, diverse businesses taking advantage of, you know, grants or programs that we have. That's where we see our success. So it's been an amazing program to hear folks say that they feel like they've never been as engaged as they have before. We're out in the community, so our ambassadors also come with us to festivals. We're all about meeting people where they are. One of the things I say is I communicate with folks how they want to be communicated with. And for a long time, folks thought that translations were just the key, and I say that's a check the box. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we're talking about really complex things, and so having someone that speaks that language that can really explain it, I think it goes a lot further than just trying to translate a document.
Does it also go beyond language? Because there's also ableism as well. Like if someone doesn't speak, can't hear, I mean, has trouble with eyesight. I mean, are there other ways to get information and resources to people?
Absolutely. So we're all about being accessible, but I make it clear that this ambassador is a cultural and language justice program. And so, you know, if someone is hard of hearing, we can always accommodate. The city is always going to accommodate anything. But this is very specific to culture and language.
And now that there's a new cohort that's going to be announced and they're going to, you know, go through training, I want to end with you, Juan Carlos. What advice do you have for the incoming cohort?
Well, they already applied, 170 people, so probably they already heard this. But I think if you're going to apply, you want to serve. That's the most important thing. Only apply if you really want to serve your community, because it sometimes is hard work and it requires wanting to go beyond what is asked for it to be really useful and as creative as it has been. So, yeah, we meet once a month and then we discuss about the issues and we get some training. It seems that that's going to increase in the next cohort. But even translating that into how do you take it to your community takes some time, because some people walk door to door. Some people organize little town hall mm-hmm. meetings in a way or just get into social media. But even that translating into simple ways, a lot of information in social media is not that easy. So it does require wanting to do something for the community, because the money, it's improved now, which is great.
Right.
But it's not what you do it for. You do it for the love and for the opportunity to link the community with the city.
Juan Carlos and Lynette, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's a privilege.
Lynette Hall is the Community Engagement Manager for the City of Sacramento, joined by Community Ambassador Juan Carlos Ruiz, and they are talking about the Community Ambassadors Program within the City of Sacramento. And that is it for Insight Live at Noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Have a great day.